we exist? Were we created with a purpose, or are we just here by chance? What are we to believe about life, faith, and worldview? Welcome to the Universe Next Door, focusing on answers to the questions we all consider. This show is a ministry of the C.S. Lewis Society and supported by gifts of listeners just like you. Join us as we seek to see a generation captivated and transformed by the truth of Christianity. This is The Universe Next Door.
So today we're going to be getting into a topic that basically 5 or 10 years ago, you probably would have been called a conspiracy theorist for bringing up. You would have been called crazy for claiming that robots are going to take over the world. But artificial intelligence is a very real thing today. It's becoming a very real thing. And there are both cultural and ethical issues attached to this. And you're going to see why. So we're interviewing Dr. John Lennox today, one of my personal favorite apologists. He's probably in the top five of apologists who have had an influence on me, especially early on as a believer. I'm thankful that he is one of the first Christian apologists that I had heard of and started listening to. I listened to his debates over and over again, and I've just been a huge fan of his for a long time. It's an honor to be able to interview him again. And I'm joined by my friend Dr. Christopher Gates. He has a podcast called the Ravel Podcast. There are two Ravel podcasts. So one of them stole the name from them. It's a terrible podcast. If you click it accidentally, you'll see it's just the worst. So make sure you click the right Ravel Podcast. It has really cool artwork, almost like a yarn ball type thing. But that's a great podcast. I've had him on in the past. I've been on his show in the past, and he's also a pastor. He's a very good friend of mine. I've known him for years. And so we both had a lot of fun doing this interview. It was a really cool opportunity. But we're going to be getting into the topic of artificial intelligence. What should we be looking forward to? What should we be kind of on alert about? And you'll see that this can both be ethical, cultural, and even spiritual. And we sort of get into the topic of the end times as well. We get into how this really can be an attempt at mocking or replicating God in a lot of ways. I am by no means an expert in this area, and this is why I'm grateful that Dr. John Lennox agreed to come on and do an episode, because he has written a book about it called 2084. We'll get into more of that later in the episode. But before we start, if you would just click the link in the description below and fill out the survey, that would be a great help to us, and we hope it'd be a great help to you as well, because you'll be entered into a free book drawing where you might win Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life. And we want to know what you guys are thinking. It'd be a huge help to us if you'd fill that out. I think it's only 10 questions. So with that being said, let's start talking about artificial intelligence. Dr. John Lennox is one of the most influential Christian apologists of our time and the professor of mathematics at Oxford University. He has debated some of the world's most well-known atheists, including Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens, and he has written a wide variety of books on defending the Christian faith, including God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God?, God and Stephen Hawking, and Can Science Explain Everything? Dr. Lennox, thank you so much for joining us. How are things in England?
It's a pleasure to be with you. Things in England are not very encouraging at the moment, so we better not talk about that.
Okay, so well, we're going to move on from England then. We also have with us Dr. Christopher Gates, who is a pastor of Mosaic Church in Newport Richey, as well as the co-host of the Ravel podcast. Dr. Gates, how are you doing?
Doing really well, Nick. Thanks for having me on today, Dr. Lennox. It is a distinct privilege and honor to be sitting here and talking with you today. So really looking forward to this conversation.
Now, Dr. Lennox, I have a question that is of great interest to me and many of our listeners, considering that the show is a product of the C.S. Lewis Society. Now, in 1962, you attended a C.S. Lewis lecture in person, and I think you're the only person I've met who has actually seen C.S. Lewis lecture and actually heard him in person. Now, of course, this must have been over 60 years ago, but can you describe what you remember from that experience?
Oh, I can remember it very clearly. You're exactly right. It was exactly 60 years ago. It will be in just a few months. And I heard several of his final lectures on the poet John Donne. It was memorable, not so much for the content. I forgot what he said, although he said it brilliantly, but it was the manner of delivery that lives it by mine, because it was a very cold winter day, and he was a big burly chap, and the lecture theatre was completely packed with students, sitting on the floor and in the windows and everywhere else. And he burst in, started lecturing. Immediately he opened the door, but he still had his coat and hat and scarf on. So he would keep lecturing as he found his way among the students and gradually took off his coat and scarf and hat. So by the time he was at the lectern, he'd already delivered 5 minutes of a brilliant lecture. And he went on for about 50 minutes, and then he reversed the process. He kept lecturing as he put on his hat and his coat and wound up his scarf. And the last words were delivered precisely as he burst out through the double doors. And there was no time for Q&A in that situation. So that was Lewis and my memory of him.
I was just going to say, it's so amazing to hear. I've read all of these things about him walking in and lecturing and then walking out lecturing, but to actually hear it from someone who sat there in person is just, at least for me personally, it's blown my mind.
Yes, I reenacted it a little bit in the film I did not long ago with Kevin Sorbo about my life. It's called Against the Tide. And it deals with virtually all aspects of the debates you mentioned and so on. So your listeners might be interested in that film.
Sounds pretty interesting. I'm wondering, since you have such a close sort of connection with, C.S. Lewis, at least having seen him in person, you know, the rest of us just are kind of limited to being able to read some of his works. But I've heard people make kind of comparisons sometimes of a person of this generation who's kind of still alive, who may have kind of received the baton from C.S. Lewis. Is there anybody alive today that you think might be kind of somebody worthy of filling his shoes in a certain sense at all? Or was that just a once in a, you know?
That's an impossible question to answer. I would prefer to say that there are many people around the world today who are defending Christianity intellectually, who owe a great debt, like I do, to C.S. Lewis. His influence has been absolutely profound. And he acted, in a sense, like a remote mentor to me through his writings.
Yeah.
And that's the way I put it. I think it's a bit invidious to specify particular people whom I don't necessarily know well enough to be able to pronounce that judgment. I don't know if anybody does.
Now, we're currently doing a series on ethical and cultural issues. And part of the reason we wanted to have you on here is, first of all, I just wanted to tell you that I remember early on as a Christian talking about C.S. Lewis. He was one of the guys who had most influenced me. Early on, I remember finding his books right off the bat. And then you were another one, Dr. Lennox. You were one of the people who I really just grasped onto early on. I watched your debates over and over again. I'd read a number of your books. I got the privilege of meeting you very briefly years ago in Georgia. But you wrote a book called 2084, and basically what we wanted to get at here is artificial intelligence is something that everybody has heard of, but it seems like maybe it's just kind of over a lot of people's heads and they don't understand it. So first of all, the title 2084, can you, of course it's an allusion to 1984, but can you give us a little bit of where that title came from?
Well, it came from an atheist professor of chemistry at Oxford, who is very famous indeed. We were sitting in a car going to a debate where I was debating with him. And he asked me what I was writing. And I told him, I'm writing on AI. Well, he said, I've got a title for you, 2084. And I said, well, that sounds terrific. If I use it, I will quote you. And if you look at the preface of my book, you'll see that that I have quoted him.
Now, is that a common thing for people to ride together on the way to a debate? What was the story behind that?
The story behind that was that I offered him a lift And he needed one, and somebody else drove us. But we didn't discuss the content of the debate. That's why we were discussing what we were writing.
Seems like a good enough idea. Now, and you mentioned in the book that the term artificial intelligence was coined in 1956. And at the time, of course, technology was much different than what it has evolved into today. And you also describe two different ways that the terminology of AI can be used, with narrow AI being one term and general AI being the other. Can you sort of break those two different definitions down in order to help us aim this discussion at the biggest issues?
Well, AI, the first important thing to say is there are many different AI systems, and there are the ones that are already in operation around the world. And then there are the much more speculative ones, which often figure in science fiction novels and films and so on. So let's take the operative ones first, narrow AI. And as the word suggests, a narrow AI system is a system that does a single thing usually and involves a computer and a large database and software that picks patterns that are desired out of that database. So for example, if you buy a book on Amazon, you'll very soon get a series of suggestions of other books like that that you might like to read. And in other words, you are setting up your own database, the computer is recording it, and then it picks out a pattern there and compares it with the available books on the Amazon database. And so it feeds you a list of suggestions. We're very familiar with that. Another clear-cut example is the use of narrow AI in medical diagnostics. Here you have the database consisting, say, of 500,000 x-rays of people's lungs with various diseases, and they're labeled by top experts in lung diseases. And then they take an x-ray of your lungs, and the AI system compares the picture of your lungs with those 500,000 pictures and picks out the one nearest to your disease. And so it gives you a diagnosis. And that is turning out to be immensely successful and being rolled out all over the world in many different disease areas because the labeling's done by the top doctors. So you're getting almost by definition the best diagnosis. And that's marvelous. And so there's a hugely positive side to artificial intelligence. And AI systems, narrow AI systems, are being used to develop vaccines. They're being used to implement all kinds of positive things that are of benefit to humanity. But then we have to realize that AI systems, I often compare them to sharp knives. A sharp knife can be used for murder or it can be used for surgery. Mm. And if you take this pattern recognition as a very powerful use of narrow AI, facial recognition can be used by the police to pick out criminals in a football match or... And of course, that's very positive. We want the criminals off our streets. But it can also be used to suppress a minority, as is happening in parts of China, as I understand it at the moment. Mm. And it can lead to huge repression under an autocratic government. And so that's a downside. And the surveillance technologies that are available for assisting the police in one country, in a positive sense, can be used elsewhere to repress a population and give a lot of pain to many, many people. And of course, those technologies that are particularly being used in China are available in the West. The only difference really is they're perhaps not yet being used by a central government. But we must be alert to the downsides. Another example, of course, is autonomous weapons. And that raises huge ethical issues where we get remote bombings, picking up of targets where they're in a completely different country and so on. And there's a huge problem policing these things because the technology is being developed much more rapidly than the ethics that should be supporting it and controlling it. So that's one kind of AI. Artificial general intelligence. The idea there is trying to make something, a system, that doesn't simply do one thing that normally requires human intelligence to do. And I should emphasize that. This intelligence is not real. It's artificial. In other words, it simulates human intelligence, but it isn't itself intelligent in the ordinary understood sense in being connected with a conscious mind. So that AGI now is the hope that, or the dream that some people have of constructing a system that can do everything and more that human beings can do. And there we're moving in the direction of trying to create a super intelligence. And that's where a lot of the hype lies. And of course, we're nowhere near it. We're constantly told that it's going to be created within the next 30 years, but the date keeps shifting. It's always 30 years in the future, it seems to be. But we've got to take that seriously as well, because it's not only the imaginative science fiction writers that are writing about this stuff. It's serious scientists saying that eventually we will be able to merge human beings with machines, and we may end up with super intelligent beings that either are kindly disposed towards humanity or simply get rid of humanity because we're in the way. And so it raises all these questions that people love to discuss of trying to get rid of our dependence on biology and conquer the whole question of human death. And I go into that in my book because that's on the agenda of many leading transhumanist thinkers these days.
Mm-hmm. I've got about five questions written down here. And I think just in that single answer, you touched on all five of them. So I'm going to pick a couple here and we'll see if we can get to those and have you kind of expound on those just a little bit. But as somebody who my degree is in biblical studies, in biblical interpretation, hermeneutics, the kind of end times and eschatology and all of that is, you know, a major point of fascination for a lot of Christians, a lot of people, you know, particularly with, you know, some of the dispensational sort of eschatology. People are really into trying to interpret the signs of the times. And as this artificial intelligence has started to become more and more mainstream, you know, it draws some people back to some of those prophecies, you know, even from like Daniel 12:4, probably one of the easiest ones in this instance to look at, where it talks about the increase of knowledge in the end times. And then you start to think about the implications of perhaps, you know, an antichrist who his agenda is to mimic and kind of be a copy of the actual Christ. So how do you see, not to make too far a stretch from the things that we're actually observing that you've been talking about to the possibilities of how these might work themselves out in an end time sort of scenario, but with this increase of knowledge, and you talked about even some of the dangers with like a surveillance state and those sorts of things, how do you see a very real connection between the possibility of what you might call the beast system or something like that with the technologies that are being developed right now?
I think that the short answer to that is, yes, I do. But we need to think about it extremely carefully, because one of the problems with biblical prophecy is that it has got into some disrepute with people speculating and all the rest of it. And my own approach to this is to look at, first of all, the transhumanist agenda, which, in the words of the very high best-selling novelist and historian Yuval Noah Harari, the agenda is, number one, to conquer physical death. Humans won't need to die. They may die, but they won't need to, because we'll have the technology to solve that. And secondly, to enhance human happiness so that humans will be immortal and they will be immortally happy. Now, my response to that is to shock some people, and I say, well, you're too late. And they ask me, how could we be too late? Well, I say, firstly, the problem of physical death was solved 20 centuries ago by the resurrection of Christ. And the problem of personal immortality was also solved by him, in that those who are prepared to trust him, repent and trust him, they are promised in this life already eternal life, and they're promised that they will be, if I may use the technical jargon, uploaded into heaven one day when he returns. So, in other words, it seems to me that Christianity has a much more credible scenario, because it actually answers these questions, if only people could see it, that many secular folks are longing for. That's point number one. Point number two is, getting nearer to your question, that is that in the secular world, if you take a physicist like Max Tegmark from Princeton, who's written a book called Life 3.0, and in it he depicts a whole series of tapestries or scenarios that he imagines might be fulfilled by artificial general intelligence. And he mentions God in some of them, that it'll be a benevolent God or it'll be a dictator. And one of the most interesting things is that the scenario that he spends most time on is a world government called Prometheus. And whatever this is, in the end, it would appear to be some kind of individual who takes charge of the world's economy and controls that economy by forcing people to wear a special bracelet that if they don't fit in with what the government dictates, then it can administer a lethal injection, all this kind of stuff. Now, what I say is this, and I say it very carefully. I say, look, if people in the contemporary world are prepared to take seriously scenarios like that, perhaps they need to revisit what Scripture has to say about the future, because it does appear to talk, albeit in symbolic language, in Daniel in the book of Revelation. But symbols are always used and metaphors to describe realities. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the imagery of beasts in both Daniel and Revelation, and it was common to depict powerful empires in the form of wild animals. It's a very natural comparison. And therefore, and it's C.S. Lewis that reminded us, don't think that because something is a metaphor, it doesn't stand for reality. In fact, the reverse is the case. And it would seem, as far as biblical revelation and biblical literature is true, that we've got statements there that if you balance the metaphors of the beasts with the plain, straightforward language of the Apostle Paul, for example, in 2 Thessalonians, where he does appear to talk about a leader with universal or global power. And what is interesting to me, and I've written a book on Daniel, actually, where I spell this out, but I spell it also out in my book 2084, where there is such correspondence in the detail that it seems to be that what Daniel and Revelation are saying in partly symbolic form, that Paul is saying in absolute, direct, straightforward prose form, and that ought to make us seriously think. Now, without pinning down all the details, because people are always trying to decipher symbols and they want to know what the number 666 means and all of that, it has always struck me as very curious that very few people see what that's all about. But the book of Revelation tells you about the number 666, that it is the number of a man. In other words, the real issue is not who it is, but what it is. That is, it is a human being with this kind of global power. Now, that's not fanciful, because we can see that there are even human beings today tragically asserting themselves to a certain extent. They're trying to get as much power as they can. And therefore, I strongly believe, both as a scientist and a Christian, that what the research, if you like, and writing about artificial general intelligence does is to awaken us to the fact that for 20 centuries, we have had information that we've not taken seriously enough because we have set it aside as if it was childish nonsense and mythology. I do not believe it is. And that could lead us, of course, into another major discussion.
I just to follow that up, and you touched again on several things as I'm thinking. You're going to the answers as I'm having the questions, so I very much appreciate that. But as you were talking about particularly the, you know, the number of the beast, and as you said very astutely, it is the number of man, you know, and there's certainly a lot of different interpretive angles that you can go there. But what I think is interesting is that when you talk about mankind being created in the image of God, the Imago Dei, and we just had a conversation on the Ravel podcast about this, the Imago Dei, and what that means exactly. And of course, people are going to have a bunch of different interpretations of what it means. But there is a sense in which mankind created in God's image, one of God's abilities is this his creativity, his ability to create and even to create life. And we, of course, are given this ability to create life through procreation, you know, through men and women coming together and that sort of thing. But there is also this other sort of angle that you could look at where, in a certain sense now, mankind is trying to create an intelligence, kind of, not biologically through the reproductive kind of means that God has given us, but through this technological advancement. So it kind of to, I don't know, maybe play devil's advocate, if you want to put in those terms, is there something right in what mankind is doing in trying to create an intelligence that is kind of in our image? If we've been created in the image of God, and part of that is the creation of life, then are we not kind of filling out that role, that Imago Dei, in trying to create an intelligence system ourselves?
Well, yes and no. I think my response to that is to say, first of all, that the statement in Genesis 1 that human beings are created in the image of God is one of the most important statements in the whole of Scripture, in fact, the whole of world literature, that gives us human beings unique dignity and value. It is the source of all our values, as even Jordan Peterson and a number of leading atheists as well have said not so long ago. That's number one. Secondly, I do believe that one of the abilities God has given us is the ability to be creative. But now, human beings are immensely special because of that. They're special for another reason, because God became one. Now, if our attempts to create a superintelligence involve modifying God's creation at its fundamental level, in other words, interfering with the genome, with the germ cell, in human beings, I think there we're beginning to get into a scenario that C.S. Lewis brilliantly described in his book, That Hideous Strength, and warned us against it, because he made the point that if we leave the modification of human beings, and the secularist, the atheist, just regards human beings as one particular stage in a long evolutionary process that has no end point, so to speak. And therefore, we are right to do anything we can to modify human beings. Well, I would say two things. First of all, enhancing human beings is different from modifying them in the fundamental sense of redefining them. I'm wearing glasses at the moment, as you see, so I have enhanced my eyesight, and I regard that as a very useful thing. But Lewis made the point that if we allow a group of scientists to reshape humanity so that all future generations will be dependent and be produced by our modifications, then they won't be human beings at all. They'd be artifacts. And that's where I see the real danger. Mm. So I don't think the fact that we are made in the image of God gives us license to destroy that image.
And certainly there's a difference between the sense in which God creates and the sense that we create. You guys may have heard this joke before, but it was about a scientist challenging God to a people-making contest. And so God said, okay, let's do it. And God picks up a handful of dirt. And then the scientist picks up a handful of dirt. And God says, no, wait a minute, go get your own dirt. And the idea is that God created everything out of absolutely nothing, and we cannot do that. We can only use God's tools. We can only use God's atmosphere. We can only use what God has given. And so do you think there's an idea that we see in Romans 1, that the creation starts to worship the creation, but in this case, do you think that the creation is attempting to become the creator in a way that they cannot actually successfully do?
Well, I think the analysis that we need is in the early chapters of Genesis, where the first temptation that faced the humans was, disobey God, and you will become as gods. Now, that is language that's being used today. Yuval Harari uses it in his book. He titles his book Homo Deus, and he says, here we are, and I referred to this earlier, the two agendas for the 21st century, according to him, are one, the pursuit of immortality, and secondly, the enhancement of human happiness so that human beings become as gods. And he says, think of Greek gods with a small g, but this is Genesis again. You shall be as God. And that temptation has driven so much. You see, we've been here before, but in a much more primitive way. The Soviets tried to make a new man. The Germans tried to create a master race, and all of this kind of thing. And we now have technologies that they never could have dreamed of to use. So the thing comes round in a circle. And it strikes me very much as if Genesis is helping us to see that this idea is poisonous and very dangerous. And Paul refers to it, you see, in his day in Rome when the Caesars were claiming to be God and all the rest of it. Now we're having a modern form of it. And it is not only blasphemous, it's anti-God. And it's the exact opposite of the Creator's intention. So making humans into gods is a parody of the true thing. And what's the true thing? It's that humans responding to Christ and trusting him become children of God, what they never were before. We're born as creatures of God, not as children of God. We can become children of God, mm-hmm. and we can receive the very life of God, but that's vastly different from grasping at independence and trying to turn ourselves into gods. And we need to spend a lot of time, I think, putting across the difference between those two to our world that doesn't understand it.
That is a really important distinction, I think, to consider, something that I will come away from this thinking about quite a bit. I was wondering, just as kind of one more follow-up, you were talking about kind of being the dangers of AI and all of those sorts of things and being outpaced by it, and we might, you know, open Pandora's box sort of thing, and we won't be able to contain it after we get there eventually, even if it takes us 30 years to get there. And Elon Musk, somebody who has been talking about this, somebody who's cautioned quite a bit about AI and those sorts mm-hmm. of things, and he has said, in order to not become outpaced by artificial intelligence, the only hope that humanity has is to link itself with artificial intelligence. And he's proposed, you know, this Neuralink, where you'll have some kind of chip or something put in your brain where it removes essentially the device that we would need, our cell phone or our computer or anything, and we would have instantaneous access. Now, I wondered, you were talking about modifications that are made, not the creation of life, but kind of modifications to it. We're both wearing glasses, as you talked about, those sorts of things. All kinds of untold dangers that could come from Neuralink. But do you think that that would be a modification, kind of like glasses? Do you think that Elon Musk has any kind of, is there anything to his argument that we need to incorporate ourselves with those? I suppose I know where you're going to go with both of these answers, but I would like to hear you kind of talk on the idea of Neuralink and that sort of thing for a moment.
Well, we need to be very cautious. And it's clear that it would be more convenient to for these glasses of mine to also incorporate a computer, like a heads-up display, and that I could control simply by thought. And I can imagine that all kinds of developments in that direction may well happen. Now, I can't judge at this stage whether this is going to be good or bad. We shall see. But it seems to me that in principle, that is very different from actually changing the human germline. But what we need, and I plead for Christians who are scientifically minded, not to shy away from being involved in research in AI, because it's doing a great deal of good. But they need to be in there to be credible scientists, but also to put the ethical framework around this. And that's where I feel that Christianity needs to be sitting at the ethical table to discuss these kind of things. The difficulty with your question is that it's generic. I mean, Musk has all kinds of stuff in his head, but until we actually see what is going to happen, we can't really comment on it intelligently. You can't give a general answer to a general question. At least I can't.
Now, just the last question before we wrap this up here. We sort of touched on this. It's hard not to, but Christ being the Word, the Logos, or the intelligence, is this, just final question here, is this an attempt to replace Christ as the intelligence? I know we've touched on people wanting to be gods, just like we see in Genesis 1 in the garden, but is this specifically, do you think, an attempt deep down to rob Christ of his nature, of his intelligence, of the universe?
Well, it's not simply Christ. He is the Word of God incarnate. And this, I believe, is a word-based universe. And I've described that elsewhere in various books that I have written. By the way, you mentioned my book, God's Undertaker. So you may not be aware that's been totally rewritten and replaced by a book called Cosmic Chemistry, Do God and Science Mix?, where I spent a lot of time discussing the significance about the statement, in the beginning was the Word. But what I would say, running along with what you're saying, is of course it is an attempt to build a kind of human tower of Babel and to reach heaven with it, and aspiring that we do not need a transcendent God who created the universe. He doesn't exist anyway. We are the supreme construction, and we will modify ourselves, and we'll turn ourselves into our own conception of God. So it'll be human beings constructing their own gods. And that is a powerful motivation within people's hearts and minds. And it goes back, as I say, to Genesis chapter 3.
Now, with everybody living in such a unique time between COVID, between AI, between just so many things that seem like what's going on here, can you offer encouragement for a young Christian believer, for somebody who wants to make a difference for Christ, for somebody who just desperately wants their friends and their family to know and to receive the gospel, to know the true intelligence, the true creator? Can you offer some encouragement?
Well, it depends entirely who the person is, because young Christians come in various kinds. Some of them are scientifically inclined and others are not interested in science and are doing something equally useful. So my advice to people is number one, live a credible Christian life. And you will find that the challenge for all of us as Christian believers, not only the young people, is not to be quiet about our faith in Christ, but to work out ways to be credible so that people will understand what we're saying. And what I say to people is, look, God will stand with you as you witness. And so don't be afraid, but learn how to get to know people and to frame the Christian message in ways that people can understand. I've actually written a little book to answer your question, by the way, which you didn't mention. It's called Have No Fear. And it's precisely to encourage young people in a day when political correctness, marginalization, everything else is coming together to silence any sort of Christian witness. And I want to encourage people to stand up and be counted, but to do it in such a way as they are understood. You know, C.S. Lewis once said, and I never forget it, he said, I will be understood. And we have to work at ways of explaining what we believe so it doesn't just come across as pious religious jargon. And therefore, I believe we need to interact with what's going on in the world today. And that's a very responsible job that particularly pastors and teachers have in churches to answer the questions that people are asking.
Well, I will link that book, Have No Fear, in the description so people can check that out. And Dr. John Lennox, thank you so much again for joining us. This has been an honor. And just thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet both of you. Goodbye.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door. Make sure you share this episode with a friend or with somebody that you know. And go check out the Ravel podcast as well. It's an awesome podcast. They have tons of guests, tons of topics. So go check them out. And we have some really exciting topics and guests coming here at The Universe Next Door. So check back Monday night at 6 p.m. every week for a new episode. This cultural and ethical issue series is just going to continue to get better and better as we learn how to see all of these issues and dilemmas through a Christian lens. See you back here next week on The Universe Next Door.